This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On today's show, we're going to hear from an Israeli writer and a Palestinian writer who grew up in a refugee camp in Lebanon. They won't be fighting or debating. They're friends. A couple of years ago, they even collaborated on a book called Gaza Blues. We'll hear from Samir El-Youssef in the second half of the show. First, Edgar Keret, who was described in the New York Times as the most famous young writer in Israel. The author of that article, Nancy Updike, wrote, "Keret's fame is surprising even to himself, since his characters possess none of the qualities on which Israelis usually pride themselves, toughness, decisiveness, and physical courage." Keret has won Israel's Prime Minister's Award for Literature and the Israeli equivalent of an Oscar for a film he helped write and direct. Keret was born in 1967, the same year that Israel occupied the Gaza Strip, the West Bank, and the Golan Heights. He lives in Tel Aviv and went to a studio there yesterday to record our interview. I asked him about his take on the war.
Well, the strange thing about the war is that both sides are really saying it's very, very temporary. We keep fighting just so we have a better kind of negotiation position the moment that we'll have to sit to the desk and decide things. So you can't help thinking that, you know, that this war is going to take another couple of weeks or maybe a month. Maybe hundreds or maybe thousands of people will die from both sides just so somebody will feel that he has an upper hand in the negotiation and can get, I don't know, a little bit more. And it gives you that feeling because usually the idea about wars, it doesn't matter what they really are, that you have always this feeling that it's kind of this sense of them being crucial, you know, that you're fighting, you never know when it's going to end, you know, you're fighting just so people won't kill you. And here, this kind of war that is basically, everybody's saying, okay, you know, Hezbollah knows that it won't be destroyed completely, Lebanon knows that it won't be destroyed completely, Israel knows that it won't be conquered. Just a question, you know, Will we gain a little bit more by killing somebody who's important in their organization? Will they gain a little bit more by shooting a missile on Tel Aviv? So it's a little bit like kind of a game of chess, you know, in which too many people are dying. So you can't help feeling that you would like things to be decided and right now, you know. Why wait for more people to die?
What is it like for you to watch television and see the amount of destruction that the Israeli forces are carrying out in Lebanon and seeing civilians and children getting, you know, bodies getting carried out of homes that have been destroyed? Like, what impact does that have on you, knowing both that you're under attack by Hezbollah, but at the same time, the Israeli military is responsible for a lot of destruction and death in Lebanon?
It's a horrible feeling, and you know, and you can't help asking yourself, you know, is any of this necessary, you know? And I said to a friend today that, you know, that in the last few days I heard the Israeli army keep apologizing, you know, for unnecessary attacks, and that I hope that they're better fighters, they are better at fighting than at apologizing, because they're not very good at sincere apologies. You really see that when people talk about this bomb hitting that or the other, they seem to be more concerned about the fact that they won't seem as good air force as they were before, then they're really concerned about the deaths. And you really, and actually, when you see the Hezbollah, you know, reacting to those deaths, they react to it as if it's some sort of a victory. You know, those unnecessary deaths seems to them like a good thing happening because it's a good turn for them. Just that, you know, you see bodies of dead children and everybody's kind of trying to explode them to their own needs, you know, and nobody really sees them for what they are. There is something very, very cynical and painful in that.
You live in Tel Aviv, which is within range of some of Hezbollah's missiles. Do you feel vulnerable there?
Look, you know, I felt as vulnerable before the war, knowing that I can have a coffee in a coffee place and the suicide bomber will explode next to me. It's not as if there was a time of quiet around here. Living in this country since I was a child, I always felt vulnerable. You know, it's not, and basically right now, I would say statistically, it's maybe one of the safest times that had passed on Tel Aviv, because there weren't any suicide attacks here. For a long time, the missile didn't hit us yet. And even if a missile hit us, you know, it doesn't kill more people than a suicide bomber does.
You have a very interesting family. You know, your parents are Holocaust survivors. Your sister is ultra-Orthodox and used to live in a settlement. Your brother was a founder of the Legalized Marijuana Party in Israel. I didn't even know there was such a party. And I'm wondering if you all have similar or conflicting views about the war now.
Well, I think that me and my brother, we feel basically the same. You know, my brother, except for forming the Legalized Marijuana movement, was a very active left-wing activist. You know, my sister's view of things is really different. She's not in any way pro-war. Actually, she doesn't really acknowledge the existence of the state of Israel. Basically, being extremely ultra-Orthodox, you know, she has a family, she has 11 children, and the way that she perceives things is really that the country of Israel doesn't exist for her, or in any sense, it isn't her country. And all the actions, you know, missiles falling or things that going around has to do with the fact that people aren't being religious and they don't do what they're supposed to do according to the Jewish religion. So you can't really have a political argument with her.
I don't understand why she doesn't see Israel as her country.
Oh, it's easy because, you know, she has a prime minister who doesn't eat kosher, you know. There are people here who decide things in a democratic way. She doesn't believe in the way of democracy. She really believes in the way of the Bible. And actually, I must say that through my sister that I love a lot and I learned a lot from, I really understood a lot of things about our struggle with the Hamas and the Hezbollah, because many people like to see those struggles as national struggles, but it's actually kind of it's a religious war. And when it's a war of religion and not war of nations, all the laws are different. The narratives are different. The ontology is different. The way that people fight against you is different. And I think that many times, in the Western world, when we talk about people who are a fundamentalist, a religious fundamentalist, we like to kind of colonialize their thought and think that they have the same values that we have, and that if they do anything, they would do it according to our psychology. For example, that if somebody does a suicide bombing, he has to be depressed or in a bad situation. But, you know, speaking to my sister or other people who are extremely religious, death really is seen in another way. It doesn't necessarily seen as a bad thing, you know. So basically, if you're a religious fundamentalist and you blow up somewhere, you could be in a very, very good mood, you know, having a very wonderful life. But actually, because you serve a purpose, you want to forward that purpose, and you see yourself as a small molecule in a bigger picture. So basically, you know, I can connect with her on an emotional level, but I understand that the way that she thinks and the way that she sees life is fundamentally different than the way that I do.
So it's interesting. Your sister, who is a Jewish ultra-Orthodox believer, has helped you understand Hezbollah.
Yes, yes. It helped me understand that really that my intuition as somebody who lives in a democracy and holds a set of values. So this intuition of mine is that what I see as the universal truths aren't necessarily universal truths. People can strive for many things. You know, for example, I always thought that people want democracy, that any society would strive for democracy. But actually, my sister doesn't live in a democratic society in her neighborhood. She lives in a theocratic society, and she thinks it's much better than democracy. She really thinks that democracy is not such a great idea. She really thinks that democracy leads to some sort of a wild and violent individualism that ruins the idea of a community. She really thinks that people really, it's not about what many people think, it's about what the people that count thinks. For example, for her, it's a rabbi. So all those things that I really always thought that everybody thinks like me, I really understand that there are some people who think in another way.
My guest is the Israeli writer Edgar Keret. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is the Israeli writer Edgar Keret, and he's joining us from Tel Aviv. Now, the best-known Israeli writers, outside of yourself, have been pretty political in writing about Israel and reflecting on Israel's life, you know, the life of the country, the conflicts the country's been in. And your writing is almost famous for not being political, for being on a smaller scale and more about certain absurdities and paradoxes of life. And I'm wondering if it's difficult to remain an almost apolitical writer in Israel.
Well, I see myself as a very political writer. It's just that my politics is different. I think that in Israel, when people talk about politics, they talk about something very reductive. They really talk about some sort of simplification of a situation. Politics a priori means that if you're political, you don't contain any sort of ambiguities. You know, like being political, it's kind of a package deal. It's kind of a pragmatic route. It means that I support this party and I don't support that party. And I really think that politics should be something much more complex than that. And being a fiction writer, when I write about life, I want to show them as complex and as ambiguous and as paradoxical as they are. And when I write about the situation, I really want to write about the ambiguities. Because to say this guy is right and the other guy is right doesn't seem political for me. It just seems simplifying and boring.
Now, you've had a friendship and a collaborative relationship with a Palestinian writer named Samir El-Yousef, who grew up in a refugee camp in southern Lebanon. And you collaborated on a book together called Gaza Blues. He's our other guest on today's show. Can you talk a little bit about the relationship you have together and how you got together?
Well, basically, Samir and me, I think each of us is kind of different among the landscape of the writers. Like, he's not a typical Palestinian writer, and I'm not a typical Israeli writer. I think that, let's say, when you talk about politics, many Israeli writers are not happy with my politics, and this doesn't mean that they think, you know, I'm too left-wing or anything. They just say, you know, he's not clear enough. He's not talking about the topics that he's supposed to talk about. He's not talking about them the way he's supposed to, you know. He doesn't have the pathos necessary to talk about those subjects. And I think that Samir suffers from the same problem. So it's actually, you know, when we met, it was like a two people support group. It was kind of like an AA meeting, you know, and the fact that we could have a dialogue, you know, and disagree about things, but still survive it because we really believe that there are some things that are more important than let's say what you specifically think about an issue, and that's how do you conduct a dialogue? Can you be critical of yourself in some situation without this being kind of interpreted as a weakness in the eyes of the enemy?
That's, you know, it, yeah.
And the fact that both Samir and me, when we talk about an issue, we just say what we feel, made us different.
Now, you were supposed to be on a panel with a couple of Palestinian writers. I think it was in Sweden, maybe. And they refused to appear on stage with you because you're Israeli. They would talk with you in private, but they wouldn't talk with you on stage. And I'm wondering what your reaction was to that.
Well, it was in Norway.
It was in Norway. Okay.
It was in Norway, and actually, one of the people who refused to be with me on stage, his name is Izzat El Ghazawi. He died since then, but before dying, he translated one of my story collection to Arabic and published it in the Palestinian Authority. I think it was maybe the only fiction book that was published in the Palestinian Authority since the beginning of the Second Intifada. And it really showed this kind of a contradiction between the fact that he was curious and interested in what Israelis are doing, but at the same time felt that he couldn't officially sit with them on stage. When he said to me, he said, "I hope that you accept it and understand it." So I said to him, "Listen, I accept it, but I really don't understand it." And at the same writers' meeting, the late Jacques Derrida was there, and he actually attacked the Palestinian writers from stage, and he said to them, "If you don't want to sit with a left-wing fiction writer from Israel, who do you want to sit with? Do you want to sit with Ariel Sharon? Do you want to sit with the Israeli right-wing? or just you'd settle for sitting with Norwegian people? Do you want to make a peace with Norway? There is something about this kind of basic statement that I really don't see any progress coming from such declarations.
So the same writer who refused to share a stage with you published your book in Gaza and the West Bank.
It was in Ramallah, but
his position remained the same.
He really felt that it was important for Palestinians to read my fiction because he thought that it would give them a different image of Israel than they had before that. And we had a very funny dialogue about it because when the book came out, I had an email from the publisher, and after that my agent talked to the publisher, and the publisher said, listen, the book says really well, we finished the first edition, but we aren't exactly sure if there are many people reading it or if the Hamas bought all the copies and burned them. We still didn't make up our mind. And another Palestinian friend of mine told me that the collection of stories was called The Bus Driver Who Wanted to Be God. And he said that he met one of his students, and the student was very, very disappointed because he thought it was a collection of stories about a shahid who explodes himself in a bus because it was the bus driver who wanted to be God. And he said, bus driver, God, there must be kind of a suicide bombing somewhere. And when he bought it and he saw it was just kind of about a story about an egomaniac bus driver, he was very, very disappointed. I think that you kind of developed this kind of a macabre sense of humor. And, you know, and that's what Samir and me have. And I feel that there is something very good about this kind of route of communication that is completely not PC, and that it's completely kind of feels okay to talk about things and to laugh about things that you usually don't laugh about it. Because when you do it, it's actually proof that you can overcome this sense of rigidness, you know, because sitting with somebody on stage or just kind of exchanging predictable slogans, it doesn't get you any closer anywhere. But being able to sit with somebody in a room and, you know, and to crack a joke about something that you wouldn't think that you'll be cracking jokes with him about is some sort of a development because it's a normalcy.
Your parents were Holocaust survivors, so growing up you knew that they had survived something very terrible. I don't know how much they actually told you about it, but I'm sure you could guess that it was really horrible. And then, of course, growing up in Israel, Israel has been part of several wars since you were born. Did you grow up afraid of war and afraid of anti-Semitism and afraid that someday maybe you'd have to face something like what your parents faced in the Holocaust? Or did you grow up without that kind of shadow of fear?
No, I grew up very fearful and very hysterical. You know,
hysterical, did you say?
Yeah, I think that one thing that I always felt is that the existence of Israel as a country and the existence of Jews as people is not something that is trivial. The idea of genocide was always somewhere in the air, and I'm not saying that it's necessarily justified, but the fact that my wife always says, you don't live, you survive. In that sense that, you know, that there always, I think, this kind of a burden, or there is this feeling of struggle or potential struggle, not necessarily a violent one, but it's very difficult for me just to be laid back or relaxed because I always kind of have all those kind of worst-case scenarios going in my head.
You have a son now, right? How old is your child?
7 months.
7 months, very young. When times get dangerous like this, do you consider leaving Israel for your son's sake so that he isn't growing up exposed to the same kind of fears and exposed to the kind of wars?
Well, you know, he's a tough kid. You know, when things get tough, I think in a few months' time we'll start hiding behind him because he's really tough. He's a really tough kid. One thing that my parents always told me is that the fact is that Israel, I may not like things or many things that are happening here, but when I argue about them, nobody can say to me, you know, if you're not happy, just take your things and leave. You know, I'm part of it. And one of the ideas that I got from my parents being Holocaust survivors is that when you're an immigrant, you never have this kind of a strong moral hold in the place that you live in. And I think that, you know, I'm unhappy with many things happening in Israel, but at least here I believe that maybe I have a way of affecting them and changing them, and I have the legitimation to do it. And I don't know if I'll feel the same in another place. And another thing, you know, I'm a writer. I live inside the language. I love the Hebrew language. And I love many things in the country that I live in, so it will be very, very difficult decision, almost impossible for me to immigrate. And, you know, and again, you know, when I was born, things didn't look any better than they look now. And I grew up, and I feel that there is always a fear, and there is always a pessimism, at least in my family. But I hope that, you know, that when they were really scared when I was born, you know, about the future of the country, they were wrong. And I hope that I'm wrong too.
Well, Edgar Carrot, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it.
Edgar Carrot spoke to us from a studio in Tel Aviv. He co-authored the book Gaza Blues with the Palestinian writer Samir El-Youssef, who we'll hear from in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.